You're listening to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. I'm your host, Amy Stone. Here, I share stories from real people navigating the adventure that I call adulting. Are you ready? Me too. Let's do this. Hello, friends. How do? In this episode, I'm going to introduce you to Sarah Thornhill. We talk about shifting from panic attacks to peace. Doesn't that sound nice? Sarah shares with us some of the parts of her life that have been challenging, to say the least. These are events that individually could all have been their own episodes and stories featured on the show: marriage, divorce, sexual identity, parenthood, family of origin stuff, and even capital T trauma. These are all things that Sarah has in her personal history. So how did she go from having panic attacks to peace? Well, let's get to the interview so that you can find out. It's time. Sarah Thornhill, welcome to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. I'm happy you're here. Are you ready for a fun chat?
Absolutely. Thank you so much for the invitation.
You are welcome. All right. I start all my conversations with my guests with the very same question. Tell me what part in the world you're in.
I'm in sunny Florida trying to avoid these hurricanes.
Yeah, no, I think that I'm also in Florida. I'm super far south. So the waiting, and luckily everything is so far, very far offshore.
Yes.
So, yeah. So we are recording this in August. So by the time anybody hears it, hopefully hurricane season will mostly be over. It's a busy time of year down here. So next warm-up question, what is your favorite way to transition from being busy, occupied to downtime?
Oh, I love to take a few moments, close my eyes, focus on my breath, and change gears, you know, switch the hats.
Very good. Very good. All right. Topic of the day. Once upon a time in your life, you turned panic attacks into peace. And I think that sounds like a fabulous thing. I don't actually know very much about your story, and I'm looking forward to learning more about it. Are you ready to talk about how this happened today?
Absolutely.
Let's do it. All right. You gave me three little bits of information that by themselves sound like pretty big life changes. And I think you probably have other life changes that are along the way too. But I actually don't know when these happened or in what order. So these are coming out and divorce number one, and I think divorce number two, if I have that right. So if there were two divorces, I think that also means there were two marriages. And I'm curious what the timeline is here. What is the order in which these things happen?
I have been engaged four times, married three. I am happily married again for the third and last time. Yes, I got married over 10 years ago to my now ex-husband. I came out of the closet, and there's a joke in the gay community that lesbians bring a U-Haul on their second date. And my ex-wife and I kind of did that number. We got married very quickly, within about 6 months of knowing one another. And so, yes, I have definitely lived through the panicky moments of getting sober. I got sober over 6 years ago, and I started meditating every day over 9 years ago. And I am a product of, yes, panic attacks early on, lots of panicky moments from the heartbreaks. And I have cultivated my own peace, my own powerful peace, day by day, moment by moment, choice by choice.
Spectacular. All right. So marriage number one, followed by a big shift coming out of the closet. And then a second marriage. So how long was the first marriage, if I can ask?
5 years.
5 years. And given the joke you made about the second marriage, was it a little shorter?
Yeah, it was a couple years.
So it was a couple years. All right, very good. Were the divorces amicable and friendly, or are they, or were they spicy, high conflict divorces?
Well, I think that there was some conflict. You know, my ex-husband was pretty perturbed that I came out of the closet. I think that's pretty emasculating for any man. And my ex-wife and I don't talk, and that is not my wish. She has chosen to be uncommunicative and bitter. And I guess I'm blocked. I don't know. But I really wanted us to have an amicable parting. But she had other ideas.
So. As sometimes happens. All right. So it seems like, you know, that is, you know, a pretty expected thing. It is, I think, definitely in a heteronormative marriage to have one of the people change and come to that awakening. I think it definitely is always going to be a challenging shift. I have heard several stories of people who are able to stay close and loving of the person who is discovering something about themselves. But it sounds like in your relationship, that was not the way that was going to go.
Well, with my ex-husband, we still have regular contact.
Okay.
And we share our daughter and we are very amicable on the surface, I guess. We're not, you know, having lunch together, but we still have birthday parties for our daughter together and we know each other's partners and, you know, we see each other all the time at her events. It's not like we're not speaking or.
Okay, so it does sound like it came to
for him. Yeah. Oh, I mean, we've got a good, solid working relationship, communicate regularly, especially about our sweet daughter, but it's not like we're besties.
Okay, so it was you feel like it was a shock to him, but you guys were able to come together and co-parent and have a continuing thing. That is very good. So then where, you said on the intake form that you realized that your perfect life was costing you your sanity. And I want to ask you if you can talk more about that and what it meant.
It was the life that my parents really wanted for me. I grew up strict Southern Baptist in Southern Louisiana. I didn't even know what a television or movie or pop culture was. It was all church music and church trips and youth group. And I was literally in church 5 days a week because I went to school there and I was in the choir and I went on Sunday morning and Sunday night. It was constant Bible beating. And so I didn't even have any awareness that I could be gay until I went to college and did discover wine and women when I was 18 years old and hid that from my parents because I knew that they would, I knew the church's stance on homosexuality and I didn't feel comfortable. So I went squarely back into the closet on the surface a couple of years after college and wanted to find the man and do the thing that my parents wanted me to do. And I did. And so it looked perfect from the outside. We had a beautiful wedding. And then, you know, I knew that I was not living my truth and in my authenticity. And I was drinking. I had some deep sexual trauma that I was covering up with alcohol. And when I really started meditating every day, I couldn't really ignore that anymore. And so I started seeking help in the form of hypnotherapists and therapists and NLP. And I got certified myself in a lot of those things, doing deep breath work releases, and found the beautiful way to start to live in my truth.
Very good.
So
so you put yourself in the mainstream box because you felt like that was the safe space for you to be, and to be accepted by the people in the community that you were raised in, I think, is one way to say that. Does that sound like a good description of the choice you were making then?
That is accurate. Yeah.
And sometimes, right, you know, sometimes we can have, as human beings, we can have sort of multiple public personas, right? So like when you walk into a bank and you're asking for a loan, you're going to dress up and present yourself in the way that you hope will be well received by that banker or by that boardroom or whatever it is. But when we have a piece of our personality, a piece of our identity that we're not listening to or that we're hiding, it's almost like trying to hold an inflatable raft like underwater. Like you can do it for a little while, but it's going to, it's constant pressure and it's going to try and bubble up.
That's a beautiful analogy. Yeah. So, I agree.
yeah. And so you were, one of the things is that this, along with other things that had happened to you, some trauma in your life, you were masking it with drinking, which is maybe one of the most popular ways to deal with that, as a human being, to buffer it and to try and just kind of get through. You knew you were in trouble. How did you know? How did you come to the awareness? If you remember, this is not a great question, but if you come, how did you come to the beginning awareness that, you know, what you were doing and the way you were living was not sustainable anymore, could not, just needed addressing. Like, so how did you begin to find your way to the conversations with doctors and therapists and counselors and hypnotists?
Well, when I would get drunk, I would shamelessly flirt with women in front of my husband.
All right. So, and, like, that, okay.
Fair, so we would have these point. Tough conversations the next day, like, you told the, you know, my friend's date that you really wanted to make out with her. And it was these embarrassing stories. And I'd be like, oh my gosh, I did. And so these like mini little blackout moments of not remembering these truths that I really was holding. It's like a truth serum, right? Yeah,
it can be. It removes the inhibitions, as we say, right?
Yeah. So yeah, just really recognizing that I was suppressing it for so long. And I, when I met my ex-husband, I told him I was bisexual, and he was like, what? He was very cautious about that. And I think I wanted to allay his fears. And so I suppressed it even more.
Yeah.
Whereas most men are kind of like excited about this and not so.
that is the stereotype that men would be excited, but obviously people come in all different ranges. But yeah,
sure.
So in a really, really, you know, in the ideal relationship, one of the things that people might say in like pop culture, like, I'm not the expert, I'm repeating things that other people say. When two people come together and it's going to last a long time, together they are stronger or more improved. They feel like the other person is improving them and adding to their life, right? And it has to be reciprocal. If you have a piece of your personality that is not accepted by the other person in the relationship, because there are probably millions and millions of relationships out there where, you know, one person is bisexual and the other is not, people march to whatever drums they want. They, you know, but if early on you knew that he had misgivings about this, and so the only way forward for security in this relationship would be for you to agree to not highlight that. But it didn't work, because when you got loaded, tipsy, friendly, spicy, you were like, oh, I want some of that over there.
Right. Yes. Yeah, so that's kind of how it started bubbling up and just got progressively worse.
So, and he was still, even with these repeated episodes of truth through wine and vino veritas, he was surprised when you finally said, hey, listen, I'm not being true to myself, I have to tell you.
Yeah. I mean, the timeline was really, I told him I wanted a divorce. We were on a cruise ship.
So you're trapped on a cruise ship and you're like, listen, by the way, even though we're only in 96 square feet together, I want a divorce.
Well, so I told him I wanted a divorce on a cruise ship. And then 4 days later, found out I was pregnant.
Oh, okay.
So I didn't get a divorce. I was trying to make it work.
Okay.
Now, that was just solely based on the relationship. That was before any of the, you know, real issues kind of bubbled up after we had a baby. And so, yeah, I then finally told him I wanted a divorce like 2.5 years later.
Okay.
When I was like, okay, I just can't do this. And then I came out publicly about a year later. I started dating exclusively women, but I didn't put it in his face, if you want to say.
Sure.
And then I did come out on social media a year or so later.
Okay.
And so I'm sure he saw that. And then when I, you know, got married to a woman, he of course knew about that. But it wasn't like we had this like, hey, I think I'm gay, I don't want to be married to a man anymore conversation.
I see. All right. I get it. I get it. I do. I do think it's an interesting choice. Like, you know, there is a time, and every time a relationship is ending, right, you have your choice of where you're going to have the conversation choices. And I did think that was hilarious that you would choose. It would come up. Sometimes people just blow their stack and it's not intentional, but being stuck on a cruise ship where you cannot get off with that person, that's a risky spot to start that conversation, I think. You have to live with it in that closed space for such a long time. All right. So,
it was definitely some, before I was certified in relationships, I definitely recognized it later on when I got relationship certification that we were the classic anxious avoidant. I was super anxious. He was super avoidant. And the reason why I finally said, I want a divorce, it was on New Year's Eve, was because of some avoidant behavior that I was fed up with that I had been talking to him about. And I guess then it became complaining about. And then it, you know, because I really wanted more attention, more affection, more of all of the things. And he was incredibly avoidant. And so I finally, it was one of those, blow my top moments where I was just like, nope, I'm not doing this anymore. I'm not even pretending. And so, it was a progression.
I get it.
And of course, you didn't actually do it for several years. We didn't actually get the divorce for several years.
It's all right. So where do the panic attacks fit in?
I had my first panic attack when I was 29, and it was about 9 months after I had suffered a deep sexual tragedy. I was a multi-man rape, and I was suppressing. I told my sister. I never went to the police. I got the morning after pill. I never did anything about it psychologically. I just really suppressed it. And that's when I really started kicking up my drinking in order to not admit it. And I was almost 29 years old, and the man that I was dating was not who I wanted to be dating. And I was working in corporate America and had a panic attack at work. And, you know, I thought I was having a heart attack. And so I went over to my suite mate and I said, "Hey, will you drive me to the ER? I think I'm having a heart attack." And of course she called 911, and I ended up in the back of an ambulance. And once I got there, they said, "Sounds like you had a panic attack." And I, of course, I've been a lifelong yogi and I'm certified and know a lot of breath. So I've cultivated a lot of practices in order to get myself out of those panicky moments. When I was getting sober 6+ years ago, even it started 7 years ago, because that was one of the things that we differed over. I really wanted to stop drinking, and my ex-husband did not want me to stop drinking because he loves it. And so I was stopping drinking and it was a problem. Okay. He did not like that. And so I was having these panicky moments while I was weaning myself off of alcohol and dealing with it with my own natural ways. And so the panic has been in punctuated periods throughout my life. And it took me about a year and a half to finally get sober totally. Like, I would have long swaths and then something emotional or psychological would happen. Yeah. And it was a pacifier of sort.
Yeah. The huge volume of like sobriety tools are really based on, you know, willpower and strategies to change the behavior. But there is actually, and I'm not an expert, but I talk to lots and lots of people. So there is a whole other field of research which is focused on applying yourself to look at the reasons people are deciding to avoid the pain as a pathway into helping people be able to make different decisions. Because if the pain is super great, like you experienced a legitimate big T trauma, an acute trauma, and you did not at the time deeply engage in any of the tools to sort of mitigate the after effect of that trauma, which is not unusual and no judgment. But then, you know, that pain is so pervasive at some point, you have to have a way to deal with it. And then the decision of how you're going to deal with it, there's a lot of judgment that people face when they make decisions that are like, I am in a lot of pain, so I'm going to choose this chemical. And it's really, really crazy because, like, sure, we like it's okay to take Xanax, but drink a bottle of wine or another substance and you're going to face societal judgment. And so it is a weird thing. It is a weird thing for the people who are going through it. It sounds like it was actually a very, very tough situation for you. The focus of the interview is not about the traumatic event you went through, so we won't poke on that. True story, I actually don't think I've ever had a full panic attack. I've known people who've had them. I've seen people witness them. You mentioned that it felt like you were dying. You thought you were dying. You went to the hospital and you were like, I think I'm having a heart attack. Walk us through a little bit more for people who, like me, have never like felt one. Because somebody who hasn't, I believe everybody who says this, because everybody says, I thought I was dying. I thought I was having a heart attack. I absolutely believe it. But for those of us who have never experienced, walk us through what your experience was like having these moments of panic.
It's so pervasive in society I'd gone through some training to know that women's heart attacks are different from men's. And I had that data of recent in my vortex, I suppose. And so I was having, you know, literal pains in my heart area, my chest. I felt like my neck was tight, my muscles were tight, and I was experiencing some of the tunnel vision and just difficulty breathing. And I attribute it, I'm like, there's something wrong. There's something. And so when you start hyper-focusing on it, what happens physiologically with a heart attack is a lot of people think that they, I'm sorry, what happens physiologically with a panic attack is that people think that they're having a heart attack. In fact, it's the most common symptom that people go to the ER with. Yep. And end up saying, okay, you've had a panic attack. Other things are people think that they're going blind because of the tunnel vision that happens. People think that they're going to pass out, that they're going to faint. They might have like a lot of tingling in their hands or their feet, jelly legs.
Yeah. Which is also a symptom of cardiac.
All of these things. Yeah. Right. And so, and especially as a woman, I was like worried, even though I was super healthy, like was a runner and a yogi. But when we start hyper-focusing on it, we're having 4 F's symptoms, you know, fight, flight, freeze, or fawn. It's sympathetic nervous system arousal. Yeah. And then we start focusing on it and our brain starts spiraling with all these catastrophizing. And that's the negativity bias in our brain that's just trying to keep us safe. And so we're like, oh, what's happening? I'm going to pass out. I'm going to die. I'm going to all these things. And then that doubles the 4 F's symptoms in our body, the fight, flight, freeze, or fawn. All the sympathetic nervous system gets kicked up even higher. And so we start breathing through our mouth, not breathing through our nose. We're breathing from the top part of the chest. And the tunnel vision is very common. It's part of what helps us actually survive if we're actually being chased by a tiger. Yep. Or if we need to get out of a tricky situation, but it spirals. So what happened to me was really normal and I just didn't know it. And I didn't even have anybody to talk to about it. And then I started experiencing some of these symptoms, but had a lot of tools already. Yeah. I was already a coach. And then I started having clients come to me and say, like, I'm experiencing these overwhelming moments of anxiety where I feel like I can't breathe. So it's like little mini panic attacks and these spiraling moments where they do a safety behavior or an avoidance behavior. They get out of the restaurant or they go take a cold shower, you know, something that will make them feel safe or make them avoid the situation. And then they get out of the spiraling thoughts because they're being distracted by something else. And I really believe wholeheartedly, Amy, that those of us who experience these overwhelming moments are primed for enlightenment. Oh. We are physiologically and spiritually primed. You know, you can call it HSP or ADHD or PTSD. It doesn't matter what acronym you assign to it. our physiology is particularly sensitive. And because we have the ability to be so connected to our bodies, I believe that we are ready for a big upgrade physiologically, spiritually, emotionally. It's just that we're misinterpreting the energy, because energy is not positive or negative. Our thoughts about it are. And yeah. Energy can never be lost or created in the universe. It just changes form.
So that is, I'm going to come back to that in just a second. I have one more question before we move into what you did with that is that when you got to the hospital, I am not even kidding. The number of people I know, it is very normal. Like you were saying, this is something that so many people go through, and they, you know, because your choice is, you think you're dying. We are trained from the word go that what you do when you're having a heart attack is you dial 911 and the medics show up and they save your life, right? But then you get there and they say to you, yeah, this is not a heart attack. How did that feel like in the moment? Did it feel supportive when they're like, hey, we think this is a panic attack? Or were you like, excuse me, no, look again?
I did seek extra sting.
Yeah.
I had my heart checked out, and it happened again with my first divorce. I was having some of the same physiology literally in my heart space and going into my neck. And I went to a cardiologist and said, I need an EKG. I need an EGG. I'm not even sure the acronym for the electrical. And they did multiple tests on my heart, and they were like, your heart is beautiful. You have amazing blood pressure. You exercise, you meditate. There's nothing wrong with your heart. It is emotional.
I think it's a hard message to hear because it's such a physical manifestation. And what I heard when you were talking about like the leveling up, which those are my words, that's not exactly what you said. It is such an unpleasant physical sensation to go through this, and the really, really intellectual process of thinking that you're dying and working with the doctors, that's like a major, it's like a real wake-up call. Something is clearly, clearly wrong. And so do you hit and that I think is what I'm hearing with this is an awareness, you're ready to step into something else. Did you hit like a singular point where you realized you wanted to work on even more than you already were? Because you said that you had some skills already, anxiety, pressure, and panic attacks. Was there a singular moment where you're like, all right, I believe these doctors, this is not my heart, I'm going to work on this? Or was it a slow evolution of awareness?
Huh. Of course, I guess it was a slow evolution because there's no single moment that I can think of. And they were punctuated. It's not like I had repeated attacks very early on. I knew that I had had an attack, and then I had some relative peace, but I have dealt with overwhelm and anxiety, what my mom called stress. I grew up watching my mom stress about everything. And I still watch her. It doesn't matter what it is. She's going to stress about something. It's how she has learned to wire herself. And so for those of us who are overachievers, who are quite successful, who are ambitious, we think that this level of stress that we feel in our body is normal.
Yep. Well, and normal can be a moving target, right? Because you can adapt to an enormous amount of pressure.
Yes.
Yeah. And then you lose concept for like what the other one feels like. And sometimes it's a finite, so moving, right? Moving houses is a project that becomes overwhelming. It's a huge amount of pressure in small points, but then it ends and most people sort of can adjust back. But there's usually that moment where you look back and you're like, God, that was so much work. How did we get it all done? But in the moment, it was just like, yeah, this is just what needs to be done. And other things require more intervention for sure. All right. So you say that you chose to do a full reset from the inside out. And this sounds to me like rebooting like a computer. That's what it reminded me of when I read it. What does this actually mean that you did?
I put myself into silent retreats every other weekend. Whenever I first got a divorce and was every other weekend, I didn't have my daughter. I was doing mirror work, breath work, mantra meditation. I was just reading, meditating, eating a little bit, walking, running. I was just in full on 2 or 3 days of self-care every other weekend consistently for over a year, really working on me.
Okay.
And finding out what's there. You know, it's so common for especially my clients to want to improve themselves. I have this problem. I want to get better. But there are very few people who are willing to take the time to look to see what's there first. You sure. know, if we want to buy a business or buy a house, what do? We get it assessed. But people don't understand that you can spend time with yourself and figure out what's going on, especially since 95% of our thoughts are subconscious.
Yes.
Yeah. The things that we're saying to ourselves were programmed from birth to 7 years old, and we're not analyzing what we're telling ourselves. And so we have to understand ourselves if we want to get better. It takes looking and really tracking and being that witness that, yeah. you know, a lot of these tools allow us. When we focus on the breath, we can allow the thoughts to bubble up and see them instead of attached to them. When we sit in quiet or apply some of these physiological things, it'll help us to let the thoughts continue. And then we can start to look at them with curiosity instead of knowing. And that kind of awareness gives us great power.
Beautiful. So quiet retreats. Does this mean that you were, and this is a question where the answer, I'm just a curious person. Were you actually going to a place where you were sitting in quiet and somebody else was restricting, or like you lock all your stuff up, or were you doing this yourself on your own?
I've done a few of those. I've done some silent retreats where, yes, you lock all your things up, some Vipassana. I've done some transcendental meditation retreats where you did have access to your phone, but it was just more meditation. But no, what I'm specifically referring to is I put myself into retreat in my home.
Yeah.
And I was very careful about what energies, people, I would allow into my sphere because I had come out of the closet. I had been fully rejected by my parents, and they, you know, were pelting me with Bible verses daily, hourly, just trying to. And so I finally had to cut off communication with them for a little while. We are in communication because they have a granddaughter. But yeah, I was really just locking myself in my house for all intents and purposes and going out into nature. And just being quieter and maybe having a conversation or two on the phone with someone trusted about the work I was doing. But I was reading books and digging deep within.
So you've actually hit on some things that are pretty well established for behavior change, right? Like, so there's the research that goes back, like probably since the beginning of humanity, that the fastest way to change behavior is to find a group of people who's doing the thing you want to do and yes. surround yourself with them, right? It doesn't matter. Like, so if you want to be a vegetarian and you move in with everybody else who's a vegetarian, it's a lot easier to do that because nobody else is doing things right. The other right. thing is also true when you're trying to make a change and you're surrounded by people who are not embodying the new version of you, whether that's people who are critical of the decisions you've made for whatever reason, or like you said, your ex-husband, he had strong opinions about your drinking and drinking as a family, all of those things. What it sounds to me like what you were doing is you were really constraining the amount of external influence while you were redefining what you wanted to be. And so that is a version of just, you know, I don't know what this next me is going to look like, but I know it's not this. And so I have to limit how much noise and interference on that sort of topic is coming my way because it makes it harder to make your own independent decision, which in the coaching space, sometimes we say you want to be an observer on your own life, you know, be a witness instead of the participant. All right. So that is the way I would do that. All right. So you had a lot of skills and a lot of training as you were going through this. So you were navigating some by yourself for sure. I am curious whether or not you had support in the form of groups, coaches, counselors, therapists, if you had people that were like offering you guidance and direction, or was it something that you wanted to and were able to navigate by yourself?
I went through a couple of therapists when I was getting sober. I didn't really love the advice that they were giving me. And so my first real coach was Louise Hay, and she's deceased. And I was doing a lot of her recommendations for neurological change before I was certified in subconscious reprogramming.
Yeah.
And I just didn't really know what I was doing, but I knew that I resonated with those tools. I did hire and then got certified as a coach with Dr. Sue Mortar with the Mortar Institute. And so that was my first kind of foray into the coaching world. I have a master's degree in education. I've been coaching for a long time, mostly high schoolers, but I also taught adults. And so, you know, coaching, teaching is a love of mine. I've been a Toastmaster for 10 years. So I love speaking and sharing. And so just getting the certification was more like a checking of the box, kind of like yoga. I've been a yogi for 20 years. I only got my certification like 5 years ago. Been doing breath work for way longer than when I got my certification. I just found all these things organically, latched onto them, practiced them, and then would get the certification.
I think that that's, I think that's pretty normal. You get involved in something, you like it, and it's good. I also think, and I'll shout out to this, sometimes we're looking for real live people to help us for things, but I'm a big believer that mentors can be people who you've never met. So in the form of somebody like Louise Hay, who, you know, is a very influential person in, a lot of like energy type spaces, manifestation. She's, you know, she's a powerhouse of a person in that sphere. She can be a mentor and a guide through her books, and through the things that she created, even if you don't have a one-on-one relationship with her. And I think that now more than ever before, where information is at our fingertips in a variety of ways, that is really, really helpful to know. Like, it's like, you don't have to like sit on a chair across the room for somebody for them to be able to help you. People are writing books and making websites and podcasts and videos that are out there. It's like almost limitless. You ask a question and it's like, poof, here's all of the information that you need. And so I think that that's a really empowering thing. Okay. So what impact did this full reset, when we're talking about being in a space of panic attacks into peace, what did this full reset have on your life? What's different today for you than the version of you that had the chest pains and was in the cardiologist's office saying, this is not my mind, this is not my anxiety, there's something wrong with my body?
The secret is that I stopped people pleasing.
Okay.
People pleasing causes panic attacks. We are shoving down who we are. We're hiding our needs because of some perception of trying to get approval or avoid rejection or any number of core wounding. And the biggest difference is I live my authenticity. I speak my truth kindly, but I don't apologize for being a woman. I feel like women apologize constantly. I don't show up somewhere and say I'm sorry immediately. And that bleeds over into just saying no thank you. And I learned, I'm not a big AA-er, but it helped me at first. One of the biggest things I learned from them is no is a complete sentence. And I say no thank you. You know, no thank you is a complete sentence. You don't need to justify or explain why you're making that decision. And so often, you know, especially growing up in the South and just growing up as a woman who, you know, we're taken from Adam's rib.
Right.
We're not breadwinners. We're not business owners. We're supposed to be mothers and teachers, maybe, maybe a school teacher, but that's our place in the society where I grew up. And so being able to step into not pleasing my parents, I did that for 40 years almost, tried to fit into their box, and it never worked. And so, you know, my wife says, if you're going to people please, make sure the people that you're pleasing is yourself. And I think that's beautiful.
It is. And I will say, you mentioned earlier that there's the idea that a huge amount of the beliefs that we are constructed, we pick up when we're very young.
Yeah.
Before, you know, which is significant because we're not questioning it at that point. And so that's one of the things, like you can find your way in an adult situation where you don't even know what you believe. Like, it really is starting over because it wasn't your choice what you were fed when you were young.
Oh yeah, we're meditating from 0 to 7. We're in delta brain waves, which is deep meditation and deep sleep, from 0 to 2. And from 2 to 7, we're in theta, which is one of the deepest forms of meditation. Most meditators are in alpha brain waves, which we slip into while we're conscious all the time, while we're eyes open. But we are in a meditative state. That's why they say kids are like sponges. We're literally just taking it all on as truth. And we're seeing all kinds of things, and seeing alcohol being used safely, and seeing our parents arguing and thinking that that's what a relationship is supposed to be, without really consciously being aware of what's going on. So, yeah.
All right. So in every interview, I have a couple of questions that when I write them, I'm not sure if they're good questions. This is one of those. So if you look back over this journey, which sounds like it was like maybe 10, 15 years, if you add up all of the things with panic attacks and identity changes, you've come to a good place. Do you think that you could have gone through this transformation and arrived at your reset point without the various adversarial events? Like, do you think you would have eventually gotten to this spot without the challenges that were a part of this journey, divorces, trauma, and things like that? Do you think that you would have eventually gotten there? Or do you think that in a really sort of bizarre way, it is the challenges that forced you to do the work to get to where you are?
I mean, there's only one way that it did happen. So it's like,
That's why it's a terrible question.
Dr. Sue says, how do we know it was supposed to happen that way? Because it happened that way.
Yes.
And I am a strong believer that smooth seas do not make for strong sailors, that it is these challenges that make us who we are. And it allows us to step into this new version. Literally, like, you go to the gym or you run and the muscle rips open.
Yep.
In order to grow back stronger. That's how babies are born without knees. I mean, we have to grow.
That is one of the craziest things about children. The first time somebody showed me like that the reason it doesn't hurt to crawl is because their knees are different, I was like, how did I make it to adulthood and not know this? Like, what is it about this was not a part of middle school biology class. I'm sorry.
Right. Yeah. We have to grow and change. And Dr. Sue Mortar talks about this bus stop conversation, this cosmic bus stop, where we have conversations with these pivotal people in our lives before we come, whether that's whatever you believe, heaven, or if you believe there's only one lifetime that we have, but she is a proponent of multiple lifetimes, and that we have these conversations like, what are you going to work on this lifetime? Oh, I'm going to work on level 10 forgiveness. What do you think has to happen to achieve level 10 forgiveness? I don't know, maybe a bus hits my car and kills my whole family on impact. And somebody has to volunteer to be that bus driver. And that's a person who loves us very much. And so it's these adversarial moments, these people like my father and my mother, who have been such pains in my side, who love me so much. And most literally, they do love me in their own way. They think that they need to save my soul, you know, but it's these people who raped me, or who really actually sacrificed to do these horrible things in order to help me grow into the kind of leader that I am.
And you get credit there too, because while the adversarial things happen to you, there are choices all along the way. You could have, at any one of these points, continued to silence yourself, continued to push down on the things, just made yourself smaller or less than, but you didn't. At all of these places, you chose the path of finding yourself, speaking up for yourself, advocating for yourself, and your path to where you are today. So I just am giving you a little bit of credit. There you go. There we go. All right. In a second, we're going to do the final questions. I want to give you a chance to directly talk about the work you do with people and how you want people to follow up with you if they're curious to learn more after they watch or listen to the show.
So you have some follow-up questions, or you want me to go into that?
No, go ahead. Sorry. Tell everybody what you do.
I show ambitious women how to turn panic into powerful peace. And I have a free masterclass. I have several thousand women on a free Facebook group that is not so active anymore, because I have a private group on school where people can join for a fee, and there's a community. We have all of the video trainings on there. And we have 5 weekly live support calls every week, so they can watch the videos in their own time. There's all kinds of downloads and trackers and things to discover what's holding them back and why the panic attacks are happening, because it's different for everyone. And then we really do a big identity change. We talk about who am I wanting to step into? And a lot of times, as you so beautifully pointed out, it's about who am I not?
Yes.
How am I going to let these pieces of myself go? And what does the person who lives without panic do first thing in the morning? And so we're literally finding out what the subconscious holds, releasing it, and then rewiring exactly how we want to show up in this world. So Anxiety Release Protocol is the name of my program. And you can find me on Instagram at Anxiety Release Protocol. I'm on Facebook. I have a personality page on my personal Facebook, so you can't really friend me anymore, because I guess that's bigger than my business page. But both of them are named Sarah Thornhill, Personal Power Coach, or Pranatova is the name of my company. And I have a very new YouTube channel called Pranatova, where I sometimes put some trainings and meditations on there. I'm a master meditation coach and use the relationship and subconscious reprogramming to help women figure out how to have a better relationship with the most permanent relationship in their lives, which is themselves.
I love all of that. So the links to the masterclass are in the show notes, wherever people are watching and listening to the show. So that is there. You have a Facebook group, Anxious to Aligned, and a membership community, which is a paid membership community on school. People can reach out to you directly if they're curious about what that is, and you can do that. I want to thank you for all of that information and those things. The easiest way for people who are watching and listening to this to get the links is to be a subscriber to the Imperfect Adulting email community, because then those links pop into your email and you just click on them, but they are in all the other places as well. All right, Sarah, are you ready for the final 3 questions?
Oh, sure.
Let's do it. These are just for fun. What is your favorite genre of movie?
Oh, well, documentaries.
Okay. She says isn't everyone's documentaries. There we go. All right.
I'm such a nerd. Yes.
There we go. All right. As a kid, I write all of these before I talk to people. So like the fact that you shared that you grew up in a Southern Baptist family adds layers to this question that are unknown and unexpected. As a kid, did you ever go to a GameSpot or an arcade? And if so, do you remember what was one of your favorite games?
Skee ball. Yeah.
Oh, we skee ball
celebration. Yes. Yeah. Celebration Station. You can really get good at it. It's
yes.
Just that right angle.
That's the reason it's so fun, is that it's not, I mean, it's random and it's arbitrary, but it's also like you're doing something 100%. I still think skee ball is fun. All right. So what is your least favorite kind of weather? Something that you could honestly just give up forever. You'd never need to deal with it again.
Yeah, tornadoes.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Gone. No need. Finished. Absolutely. There you go.
Yep.
There
Don't
you
need
go.
them.
That's it, Sarah Thornhill. Thank you so much for being a wonderful guest today on the show.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening today. I hope that you enjoy the show. And before I go, I want to encourage you to become a bigger part of the conversation. Obviously, subscribe wherever you're listening to the show. Listen to more episodes. That'd be great. Obvi, again, please write a review and tell your friends about the show. That truly is a great help for getting the show in front of new people. Okay, but more fun for you yourself, head over to imperfectadulting.com and join the email community. You'll get some free stuff right away, and that way you'll begin to get the emails about the podcast. This includes the links for the special offers from the guests, and it's the only way to get that. Also, if you aren't in the mood to listen, I actually include an article directly in those emails. Whee! Now, if you love this and you crave more time with me, Amy, as a coach, a mentor, or just adult to your adult, numero uno, check out The Village. If you have a story you want to share with the listeners, I'd love to hear from you. I have an open application. Just let me know you want it. And that's a wrap for today. Until next time, remember, the journey is the destination. Ralph Waldo Emerson said that, not me. Well, until just now, I did just say it. But what I want you to hear today is that if your adulting journey isn't going the way you expected, that may not mean that you're lost. It may just mean that you're on your way. This is Amy Stone, signing off. The Imperfect Adulting Podcast is created and produced by Amy Stone and Amy Says So. Anything expressed on this show is offered as entertainment, and the views of the guests may not always represent the ideas and viewpoints of the host. That's me. Amy does not intend or hold herself out to provide professional advice or recommendations of any kind. In the end, you and you alone need to make those kinds of decisions based on your personal and individual situation, needs, circumstances, and comfort level.